You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
Investors in China tech stocks have been rattled recently by a regulatory crackdown by the State Council of China. With me to discuss the matter and its implications and potential implications for certain asset classes is Alan Siao, who's a portfolio manager at 91 in Hong Kong. I think we need to go back a little bit, Alan, before we get to the educational sector. And we have to go back at the origins of this. And to me, it started with the Alibaba Pay platform, the listing of which was curtailed because of regulatory concerns. Am I correct in that assessment?
Yes, you are. I mean, I think what we've recently seen is merely the latest point of a long arc of policy adjustments, both in China as well as more broadly in the world, as governments try to adjust to the emergence of new economies, right? New business models that, frankly, are not regulated, if at all today, very well.
Okay, and then it escalated a little bit with the Didi story. And then there seemed to be, a little bit of tit for tat between the United States and their assessment of what was going on with China's tech stocks on US exchanges with the China authorities. But what's behind this? Is it because they're becoming too powerful, or is it because the power is fine, but it needs to be regulated by the China authorities?
So there are actually quite a few different threads in this conversation, and I think part of the market response has been a confusion or conflation of these different threads. So let's try and separate them. I think the first is that there is definitely an adversarial competition between the United States and China economically now that China has emerged. And one of the key disadvantages that China sees in itself is its deficiency in tech, especially the tech of the future. So this is a race that they would like to be competitive in, not necessarily to win from the Chinese perspective, but merely to stay competitive and to be able to not be blocked from joining the table and having an equal seat at the table, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
So the way I think this initiative is being seen domestically in China is, you know, we have emerged. We're not interested in dominating, but it's time that the world recognizes that we are no longer a poor cousin. And in order to prove that, we need to be an equal. And technology is one of the areas where we need to catch up. So that's one thing. I think in America, this is seen differently and by different constituents. I think you have, you know, some members of the political persuasion who see this as existential and that it's a winner take all. There can only be one. And others who see this as, you know, more of a, you know, still a competition, but where, you know, we can accommodate more than one winner. So that's all to be seen. Separate to that competition, then, you then have the security element, which is China's emerging clout as a military force in the region as well as externally. This also extends into, for example, cyber warfare. So we've had these, you know, recent sort of groundbreaking accusations led by the U.S. and its allies in the Five Eyes Alliance that China was, you know, named as a state actor in hacking of U.S. interests on shore, right? So that's two parts two threads of that conversation. So, you know, the pure economic, and then there's also the geopolitical security angle. The third level, which I think is the least well understood, is just internal to China. Much as they'd like, you know, they understand they're in this breakneck race against the world and the U.S. in particular to sort of, you know, get to the position of leadership in certain technology spheres. They are still trying to figure out, you know, how this can be accommodated in the context of the Chinese cultural setup and economy, right? So how does the new internet age look like under Chinese characteristics, to borrow an oft-used phrase, right? And one of the negatives that they see that comes out of this is, you know, how does this affect the fabric of their society? So when it comes to just purely the education sector, I think it's a key thing to note that this is not, you know, a tech question per se. This is because they had noticed that there was a large and growing market for after-school tuition for children from kindergarten to year 9. So this is the, you know, young children.
Yes.
And the growth of this sector was being, if you like, turbocharged because of the arrival of capital from the West, because these businesses managed to tack on the glamour of being, you know, a technology business, right? And that was really the addition of Zoom, the addition of video, the addition of internet telephony to make these classes, to move them outside of their sort of traditional offline setting into an online business, right? And these businesses then attracted a huge amount of foreign capital, mainly raised in equity markets. And China has been grappling with this for the last 2 or 3 years, not just now, right? So the issue that they see is China wants to have a meritocratic system where children throughout the country can aspire to good jobs by taking one exam, the famous Gaokao, which determines, you know, much of their future.
Yeah.
And so parents, understandably, have been grooming their children for this exam. And the arrival of these tuition centers and their turbocharging was creating a lot of pressure and inequality. Much in the same way, in parallel, the same competition is being played out in America in the university admissions system, right? Has been the subject of recent documentaries. Richer parents being able to better prepare their children, and then gaining places at prestigious universities that are supposedly meritocratic, but in reality, you know, sometimes there are side doors, back doors, if you like, and all of that stuff. So China's approach is to say, we don't want, you know, we think this creates unnecessary pressure. So first, this industry as a whole, we don't like. We don't like what it's doing to our children. And we also don't like that foreign capital is benefiting and allowing the rapid growth of this in a way that we don't have any control over.
So they want control. They don't mind the theory behind it. In other words, educating China's youth, because the education system in China is extraordinary compared to the West. I mean, children working 6.5 days a week and studying assiduously, whereas maybe the West is deemed to be slightly more lazy in that regard. What they want is not to curtail these activities, but to have some control over them. But what I don't understand is, Alan, if you and I set up an online education business now, there'd be two aspects to it, to my mind. Vocational, because we want to educate children, and two, with a profit motive. If you take away the profit motive, which the State Council of China seems to want to do, then the vocational aspect may seem less appealing.
Sure. So, look, I think you're spot on in terms of the insight there. So then we need to go a level deeper to understand what is the relationship between the profit motive and this control element, right? So, you know, I guess it comes back to how you see the competition. So they have a entrance exam, you know, welcome to the rest of your life exam, basically, where they believe that, you know, a rural student should be not disadvantaged versus an urban student who has more benefits. If you allow these classes and they are allowed to be for profit, that means that you will then have a sliding scale of price where richer customers are able to afford better service. You are de facto then providing an advantage to wealthier customers. And China is extremely sensitive about the creation of inequality within its social fabric. And so it cannot the whole socialist ethos, you know, will be, it's toxic to that ethos to have the concept that, you know, your one sacred exam is gained by the rich, right?
Yeah.
So that's why they want to remove the profit incentive, because they want to remove, if you remove the profit incentive, then there's no one there who's going to provide a premium service. Then everyone will get the same service, and then you can't say that it's unfair. So it's not that they don't want kids studying, or, you know, they want them to study under their own power. They don't want any external help, and they do not want any accelerant to be possible through the provision of capital, right? That's the first element, the fairness, right? And you can see that that is, you know, culturally, let's say, specific, because you and I or someone else may look at that and go, that's a bit, you know, perhaps naive or utopian or dystopian, but that's philosophically, that is one angle of where they're coming from. The second is many of these businesses also were providing tuition to children onshore in China from teachers abroad, right? Because that was the whole electronic portion of this. Post-COVID, there was a big introduction of, oh, we can now bring you English teachers from the West direct into your living room, right? So no longer will you, person stuck in small rural town, have to contend with English language instruction from whoever happens to be in your town. You can now get that from everywhere else. And you can get that as young as kindergarten. So there are elements of the Chinese Communist Party who might look at that and say, do I like the idea of an unvetted, uncontrolled consumption of instruction from the West into the young hearts and minds of my population? You can see why they would find that hard to stomach.
Okay, yeah, I understand the theory behind it, and you've described it so well. Let's have a look at the market reaction now. You come up with 5 points in the piece that you kindly sent me a couple of days ago. It says here, market reaction has been abrupt and spilled over. Beware sweeping extrapolation. Without going into each of the five in too much detail, we have to get your general views on what has happened. Was the market reaction, whether it be in the equity asset class or the corporate bond asset class, has it been appropriate or has it been overdone?
So I think with hindsight, we can say that it was overdone. Certainly, when it was taking place, it felt really awful. I won't lie. And I think the other part is that sentiment towards investment in China this year has been weakened because of a series of such challenges to confidence, right? So this thing in isolation maybe would have been interpreted with a more level head, but because it came hot on the heels of other issues, some of the other things I mentioned, the cyber, the issues with Huarong, it formed part of a pattern. So, and there was an extrapolation because the statement that came out was specific to this sector, and the only nexus between this case and the broader market was the use of VIEs, and secondly, the sort of soft connection between these businesses, tuition, to the broader tech space because of the online element. So in the absence of any clarification, I think investors were, it was fair that investors who had been burned elsewhere and in other ways this year, reacted by selling first and asking questions later. I don't think that was necessarily a crazy thing to do. We looked at it and also follow the price action on the day, it all happened very quickly.
Yes.
So it wasn't as if there was an opportunity to consider, right? So I wouldn't want to begrudge my peers that acted because they felt that was the right thing to do. For us, it was okay. Hang on, they've said something very specific about this sector, and this sector is something that they have been talking about and been unhappy about for 2 years. Had been threatening regulation. And finally, they've come out, and the regulation seems more draconian than we expected. So the removal of the ability to make a profit, the forbidding of foreign capital, that was something we've never seen before. So very draconian, but very narrow. And so the key question was, what is the read across? Does this affect everything else? So clearly the market judged that there was a read across, and it also judged that this means the risk premium for China overall had to go up. And I think that was probably a fair reaction, right? And there's an element of recursiveness to this because given that reaction, I think the authorities in China then stood up and said, oh, what happened there, right? We thought we were saying something very specific about one area, and it looks like the market thinks we mean everything.
Well, I think what they said, I think if you're an investor looking at China and the potential, your potential or increased investment in China asset classes, you say to yourself, well, if this can happen just out of the blue on a Sunday night, then maybe it can happen again. And whether it's the education sector or the ride-hailing sector or the food delivery sector, whatever it is, the fact is it can be done. So we're very nervous. That brings me to the last couple of questions, the first of which is, has this done lasting damage to China's reputation when it comes to being an investment destination?
So I don't think it's done lasting damage. I think it's certainly set their stall back, right? I mean, this is not a trivial, minor speed bump. This is something quite meaningful. And some investors that perhaps acted quickly, are now going to think again before they rejoin the fray. So I think in the long term, China's prospects are undimmed. But in the medium and short term, I think it will create a heightened sense of risk about the prospect, right? And it is then incumbent upon them to make investors feel comfortable by providing clarity and certainty about things. Because the wider arc, and if you listen to other state organs in terms of what they say, you know, they're very much committed towards internationalization. They're very much committed towards having foreign capital come into the country, because the wider project, right, is for China to emerge and continue emerging. Obviously, these objectives are in tension. You know, they want to be more and more part of the world, but they equally want to maintain their own sense of identity. And I think that, you know, on this occasion, it was just, you know, as a colleague of mine in the Hong Kong office said, you know, it, a little bit of a lost in translation moment, right? So something said primarily for a domestic audience was then reverberated around the world through the lens of you know, a Western audience, and there was a misunderstanding, right? Now, because it's happened as part of a pattern, I think that's the other telling point. You know, I think, you know, Chinese authorities now have to be extra careful, extra sensitive about their next steps.
And sorry to interrupt you, they are being extra sensitive because they got a lot of investment bankers behind closed doors and clarified their position on this regulatory shift, which was so dramatic and rather probably clumsily handled. Let's talk about the markets now. Focus on fundamentals and keep an eye out for opportunities, you say. We'll briefly talk about this. Risk, obviously, presents opportunities. So what you've got to do, especially with reference to the corporate bond market in China, there must be companies that got unfairly punished when it came to their corporate bond market and, as I said, presented opportunities. Have you seen them?
Yes, indeed. I mean, on the day that the news broke, I mean, so here there's a further distinction, which is that the policy change, let's say we believed that the policy change was applicable to more than just that one sector. Even if that were the case, the impact of the policy is very different to, you know, whether you are an equity investor or a debt investor. As an equity investor in a fast growing, you know, in a growth sector like tech, right? What you're really doing is paying a high premium for potential future growth, and a policy which radically undercuts that growth or that profitability should give you pause. As a debt investor, what we're really looking for is companies, not so much that are growing, but companies that can very comfortably service their debt. A lot of the companies in this sector have raised very large war chests, so their balance sheets are very strong, at least for the moment. So these are companies that have net cash, no leverage, no debt, or more cash than debt. And they can survive many lean years before their credit profiles are even damaged. Many of them have much stronger franchises that span more than one sector. So even if you imagine they take, you know, an entire sleeve of the business away, they often have more than, you know, other sleeves that they could rely on. So there is a differentiation between the equity impact and the fixed income impact. And then there is also the point that, you know, one needed to have thought about whether or not this was something that would spread everywhere or just be confined to one place. So we did see opportunities because there was indiscriminate selling in the sector, in tech and in other sectors that people felt were exposed, either because they had a policy or tech sensitivity, and they were unfairly punished. And we have seen quite a sharp reversal of that just after the clarification during the meeting, as you say, where the senior Chinese regulators met with investment bank executives from Western institutions behind closed doors. And I think that that retracement is not yet complete. So the opportunities are still there. But equally, I don't think policy-wise we're also fully out of the woods just yet, because there will be more twists and turns to this tale.
Yeah, I think there will be as well. Fascinating situation that's developing and a great analysis. Alan, thank you very much for your time. That's Alan Siao, who's a portfolio manager at 91 in Hong Kong. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.